so Neil, I'm gonna pull up your slides and keep it alive.
I was gonna give a little bit of a perspective from the standpoint of SWIFT mission. It's done a lot of follow-up, but then leading to a few general points about the future. Okay. So SWIFT has been partnering already with LIGO since S6 and even before that. And we've done a lot of follow-up observations. It's a small explorer mission. It's a NASA UK Italian mission. And since its whole purpose in life is following up gamma ray bursts or detecting them and following them up and looking at other transients, our SWIFT team has control of the observing time, almost all of the observing time for SWIFT. So it makes it particularly good for being able to jump on a gravitational wave trigger and spend a lot of time observing it. We just had a senior review of all the operating NASA missions, and we highlighted the gravitational wave follow-up. And actually, we got a number one ranking, so we're doing good for the next 2 years. Thank you, guys. But actually, on the other hand, 2 years ago, one of the negatives we got was saying so much about gravitational waves. So, see how the world has changed. And those are the list of the science topics that we've had. And SWIFT operates in several different ways. We can either detect a gamma ray burst or what some kind of electromagnetic pulse from the prompt emission tied in with the gravitational wave event. That hasn't happened. That may have happened with the GBM instrument on Fermi for the September event. But then really what we mostly are doing is immediately when we get a trigger, and I'll get to that in a minute, but that can be within minutes even. It certainly can be within an hour, but most of the delay right now is on the side of LIGO or Virgo, getting the trigger to us. And we have two ways of doing these observations. One is to do these large-scale tilings with the narrow-field X-ray instrument and UV optical instrument. But you can see, even with a lot of tilings, we only cover sort of a square degree. So, there aren't any sensitive X-ray telescopes, instruments, that can cover tens or even hundreds of square degrees. So that's hard. And so instead, we've been adopting the galaxy strategy, which is we look at all the nearby galaxies that are within the error box. Of course, this works best for neutron star mergers, where the distance is not that great. And so, it was very hard to follow up. We did the best we could with the black hole, with the triggers we've gotten so far, but it was hard. And so, really, for a lot of the electromagnetic follow-up teams, the real goal for the future is to have gravitational wave triggers from neutron star mergers, where we would expect to see some bright electromagnetic radiation. And but maybe we'll find something. We're going to keep plugging away at the black holes too. There may be surprises there. And so I would say, Peter said pluses and minuses, but of course, I'd say the program has worked out. The MOU program has worked out really well, thanks to Peter and lots of people that have been organizing this. And one thing, I was on this EM task force that was originally figuring out how to put this together. And I was personally skeptical that some of our follow-up groups would really join in. And so when I saw that the Sri Kulkarni group joined in, I knew that this was going to work. People have really, I think, jumped on this as a good thing to do and to join in. And the rules were not so restrictive to prevent people from wanting to do it. And the payoff, of course, would be great. I know. And Ido Berger still has comments. There will, of course, be complaints and comments, and we should listen to those because we're going to learn from them. SWIFT will continue to put as much time as we can in, whenever there's an alert, we spend like 3 solid days observing those error boxes. You know, even after the alerts are public, we'll be looking for neutron star and neutron star mergers, but we're going to keep following up the black hole mergers until they become so numerous that, you know, we're just swamped with them, which may happen when the sensitivity for LIGO and Virgo increases. And we go out to even further ranges, and we may get events every day or every few days. So these last two things are kind of some of my key points. It's really important to have this prompt information available. And I know that's everyone's goal in the room here too, but especially, you know, everything that you know, it's much better for the science to let that information out, especially to our partners, than to hold something back. And it can be something that you don't know for sure. There can be a probability on it. But certainly if we know it's whatever information we have about the type of merger or the type of event that it is, that can make a lot of difference on the strategy, galaxy strategy versus tiling that different groups will use. And the public release of all the triggers, I think, will give the greatest science outcome. And so I really look forward. I realize that makes sense that that's not going to happen in O2, given the rules that we set up ahead of time. I'm very much opposed to the idea of not holding on to our first neutron star merger event and not letting that out, because I think the more people that we have, it's going to benefit us as much as the community and give us more science in general. Okay, that's it for me.
So thank you, Neil. So next is Antonia. Let's see. Can you try and speak?
Hi, yes. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Brilliant. Okay, so I'm Antonia Rowlandson. I'm currently speaking to you from Amsterdam, where I work at the university here, and also ASTRON, the Institute of Radio Astronomy in the Netherlands. So I'm here actually representing 3 of the radio follow-up facilities. Those are LOFAR in the Netherlands, and MWA and ASCAP, who are both in Australia. So these 3 instruments are all very wide field instruments. LOFAR and MWA are working at the low frequencies, whereas ASCAP is working at the gigahertz frequencies. And from my collaborators, I also have been asked to highlight that joining the effort soon are Meerkat and Apatief. So, you know, more facilities are coming on board. Our specific sort of requests, for the future are very, very similar to what we've just heard, that these sort of the rapid communication of the source parameters, especially if it has at least one neutron star, is really important for us, because at some point we're going to have to choose which events we're going to follow up on and how we're going to follow them up. But particularly for the low frequencies, one thing I'd like to highlight is for us, actually, the very rapid identification and communication of triggers via any sort of low latency pipeline is going to be really, really important. So if we can move to the next slide, I'll go into a little bit more about why this is. So here I've shown a figure of, you know, particularly for the neutron star and neutron star black hole, what types of things we expect to see. And I've adapted this from a paper that hopefully most of you have seen. But in the radio, we actually are starting to expect, from various theories, coherent emission to do with either the final stages of the merger or from the remnant that's been formed after that merger has happened. So that emission is going to be from sort of the merger time up to a few hundred or maybe a few thousand seconds after the merger. We do have a little bit of a natural delay time here. We have something called dispersion that means that the signal can actually arrive a few minutes later, so we can actually in theory, look back in time a little bit. But for us to capture that coherent emission, we need to be able to get the triggers fast. And we've actually proven that we can do this, or we can observe quickly using the MWA, where we were actually able to observe a gamma ray burst 26 seconds after the gamma ray burst occurred, and that was 10 seconds after the GCN notice was received from SWIFT. So the radio facilities are sort of, in particular for MWA, ready to go with this mode. They can cover a large field of view in one go. LOFAR is also developing this very fast response, and can cover large fields of view. So if there is any way of speeding up these triggers, perhaps sending out to MOU partners only a very preliminary trigger that has had no vetting, just saying, you know, there's something here, we're not sure if it's real or not yet. If you're interested, go for it. And also, you know, continuing to speed up the pipelines to actually get this out faster and faster. And then the number of triggers that we can accommodate will actually depend on what facilities we have and how many triggers you're going to provide. So we're looking at different methods where we can have a shallow response for many triggers and a deeper response for, say, two or three triggers per observing run. So again, this is where as much information as you can provide quickly is really useful for us to help filter those. And that's, I think, my main point. Thank you.
Thank you, Tonya. Thank you also for being up so late to be part of this. So I would follow this with Jim.
And then we'll do another question again.
My name is James Mattis. I'm from the lab. I represent the Dark Matter Survey UW. We're in this large glass, big silicon array axis in the space of multiple follow-up people. So I'm concerned of different small telescopes. For one thing, we have delivered a process to decide how we're going to follow up an event with our global timing test. So for O2, we would do, we argue the following are crucial for informed follow-up from us. We need localization maps, we think this information should come from localization maps, preferably in a map kind of setting. We believe the detection significance should come with each alert, and we believe the nature of the source. We get probability that the object, the lower mass object, is less than fusel mass comes with it. With that kind of information, we can decide scientifically where to spend our most of the time on this. We are not in a position to follow up every event. We are very happy with the idea of going to public releases in O3. No problem there. We actually have no strong opinion whatsoever about the first thing we talked about. Once we private, we don't care. Once we public, we don't care. See where it makes sense. We're both, in the end, we're a statistical astronomer. We want to get population. We don't care about single event. And you can the first one. It's not our thing. So, what model for collaboration makes sense for O3 in the following years? Right? Especially when you assume that all these public releases happen by O3. So, I think actually most of the optical astronomers won't want to do anything. They'll just take the public. Releases as we go about their business. I think that's okay. We're not in that regime. We prefer something else. So I want to remind you that DES is 300 scientists with 500 people. It's a fourth year telescope with a world class camera. There's about 10 to 15 people active in the DSUW group. And in itself, the collaboration is an independent astronomer with DES. We built a collaboration model and it works for us. Our goal would be that you evolve the model from a structured database into a scientific analysis. So an MOU based on, you're going to write a paper, this is the data we need to write a paper, and here's what we're going to do, this is how we're going to go about it. The DS is comfortable with MOUs. We've had them forever. We have one with a South Pole telescope that got South Pole in CMB, actually. We have a grand MOU with them, which just makes it easy for any group of scientists to propose a joint data analysis using both data sets. with the aim of a paper. We have maintenance agreements to make sure that the paper gets done. And people use both each other's data. And information flows back and forth. Life is good. We believe in that model. It works for us. The average is that you follow it. We particularly are uncomfortable with our LIGO ladder having to be very, very careful with one another. They tend to go on mute and talk about what can we say to you. You know, it kind of shouldn't really work that way. We'd rather have a scientific give or take with our collaborators on how actions follow the end up. And the sooner we get past that, the better off we're all going to be. So in the next half decade to decade, we're part of a program, not just a project. The DESI instrument will come online, which will do a wonderful survey for this group, the Bright Galaxy Survey, which is spectroscopic redshifts of something like a million galaxies, all L-star galaxies at redshift a half or less, so that's a couple thousand megaparsecs, over 20,000 square degrees of the sky. You know, that's a wonderful thing for this, for the black hole event and the neutron star event. Great day to do so. The LSST is going to come online. It's going to do half the sky in 18 nights, very few depths. And the alerts are going to go public all the time. The Dark Energy Survey, Dark Energy Science Collaboration, is a group of people who work at fact, the Dark Energy Science, who are cosmology, out of the LSST data, is going to exist in kind of their cosmology. There's going to be a small group following up GW events. If all three of those objects, it might be us, most of us are involved in all three projects, it might be a different group. It's all going to be very valuable for our collaboration. And we think, what the question to be asking is, so what kind of MOU structure can you have that allows small groups of scientists to get together and do simple analysis with both data sets to maximize the science teaching from all of these big projects?
Thank you. So we also have Kemp Chambers listed, but he couldn't join us, unfortunately. So next week they're from one of our search chairs. He's going to be able to. Well, yes.
So I'm going to, I tried to put together a few notes. I think this is going to echo a lot of what we've heard from the panelists and also from Peter, actually. So certainly in O2, we're aiming for more powerful alerts. What I have in my head is something like 30 minutes after minimal vetting. Though Peter mentioned, there's the possibility of getting the preliminary event out sooner. One question for LIGO folks is, do we want to do that? And what's our decision-making process for deciding if that's okay? So I'd like to get that in the radars and DAC and LIGO leadership, if we can send the preliminary alerts. So this is, we've heard from the panelists about the need to have clear communication. I'm going to make a personal suggestion. I think we have a good vehicle for that in place, which is our EM follow-up group co-chairs or liaisons. So Leo and Peter and Marika are the people probably best poised to have this communication. And personally, I'm going to advocate that we encourage them to liaise, to speak freely. And those are people that we trust a lot, and I think that they should be empowered to have frank and open discussions with our partners. So that's the suggestion. Certainly we understand, I'm gonna echo what Peter said, and we understand some of the frustrations. A lot of things work really well in Nova, which is great. But we understand some of the frustrations in terms of open communication. We understand the need to have up to date information about what we know about transition wave events. We've heard all those concerns and certainly appreciate that. One of the things that I think at a technical level we can do better in O2 and beyond is to internally flag any possible gamma ray burst coincidences and be prepared to share that information as well. I think we have a lot of tools in place to do that. But I'm not sure that we have the mechanisms in place to communicate that properly with our the partners who would certainly, maybe they'll recognize that on our own, but if we have those notes, we should certainly. And then there's this question of how the MOU structure is evolved once we have public alert. Peter suggested a number of possibilities. You know, maybe we want to collaborate on particular papers. Maybe we would want to provide more detail or lower threshold triggers within the MOU bubble. My personal take on this is that we should think critically about if MOUs are needed. Maybe in talking to our astronomer partners, maybe we'll find that many of them won't be interested. Maybe many of them will say, well, you know, we get the triggers and we can work more lightly, you know, we can work more nimbly on our own. But maybe there are opportunities to collaborate on papers and pursue particular projects. So, you know, my thought on this is we should think carefully about why we're having the MOU and what we want the outcome of that to be, right? And so there may be opportunities here, but I think we have an opportunity to define what we want these, you know, if we want an MOU partnership, I think we have an opportunity to define what we want out of that MOU partnership. And I'll stop there.
Thank you.
For discussion now. So Eric is going to pass around the microphone and just keep your hands up and let us know. So Salvo, then Dave, and another.
I think the question for Jonah and something which was already hinted by Peter is the human vetting, which very quantifying half an hour. And this is another magnitude more than what it takes for us to put something integrated with it, which is mean scale. And now, I'm not the expert, but the most of this seems to me like it's psychological, like you don't start the post alarm or something. Now, I don't know what is better for you, for the person who eventually behaves to write about the case, but I would think that, you know, having something in a minute, in a few minutes, rather than half an hour, would justify getting an extra, you know, event which is not real or something. Overall, we can just, which I think has been done, and maybe I think we have tested as a post alarm and this particularity. It's, you know, true, meaning that it is a post alarm once a day, you will get more event like that once a day. So I don't understand this fear of just sending things out automatically based on the post alarm.
You want to reply?
I can't see the other hand go up to the second. I have to be able to do the other thing in some way. I'm sure we'll be able to say the fact that it's I mean, I think that the fossil library works except when it doesn't. I mean, like, for instance, there were the RF45 questions the which rate. Where, you know, the false alarm rate is not well represented in the fact that these are glitches that occur for whatever reason. And they all look like they're all, you know, the pipeline labeled them all as a gold plated events.
So, is any other follow up on this issue? Okay, Gabby, please speak close to the microphone because Teams, you know, on TeamSpeak it can be hard.
I have asked this question before, but I feel I'm going to be disappointed about the number of events we had in advance, because even if we threw away some, because there were some other topics, I think in other cases, it wasn't obvious that good stuff that everyone said did not look at conventional ways, but that's not what we have to study for the last session. So I think we have to analyze this and what what was the last session we want, and then there's another automatic retraction possibility. I think it's a very much advantage that we have to do. About Jim's comments that somebody mentioned, really related to this. I hope people appreciate that it is very difficult to set up this and to begin with, in part because we were so unsure about how the detectors were going to work, what kind of voltages we were going to have, what the bird detection was going to look like. And as we said many, many times, given the history of the sea, there was no going to detect. So it was, I mean, we were very, very, very nervous about sharing information that it all was fine, but if we had discovered that story is complex, it wasn't a binary black hole, it was a glitch that we discovered later, reputation would have suffered a lot. We are a lot more relaxed now.
Dave? So we have Dave and Albers. Then I'll take more.
Sorry, two questions. So the first question is about the last bullet that's on Joe's slides here. Are there, and this is on a small sample, but are there groups that sounds like you would actually prefer to have a pretty deep and meaningful MOU, even in the era of all the works? So I don't, I mean, other astronomers might want to do that too, so I think that it can be self-selection process. So if you split through.
Yeah, we'd like that. Especially if there's some extra things we got, like, send us the false alarms, but only to the MOU.
Right, or some threshold we can change to the false alarm rate or something.
Yeah.
And then my next question ties back to the last one, so I'm responding to it. So Peter had a good suggestion, which was, have some automated pipeline send an alert and then have to go to the clock back in some set period of time. Is that something that would be more suitable, provided again, the false alarm rate is tuned so that you're not getting it?
Absolutely. That'd be great for us. I'm pretty sure that a lot of follow-up cases are dependent on fast follow-up. Ours isn't. We have enough time to deliver the process to decide follow-up at any moment. So we're okay.
I get example two, but it sounds like it's.
But Antonia mentioned
it. And Antonia gathered it. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, that's the case. Others does benefit from being fast. And that's important to recognize that those cases are there.
But the NewConStar binary merger is sort of expected after that.
Yeah.
I think a lot of these small telescopes are going to happen because that's their time is cheap. They want to be able to follow up.
So we have Alberts, Andre, and David.
I want to go back. Ray asked whether the astronomer before making the observations. The director of NIOSIS and our former advisory committee, one thing that he opined was that as a director of a major facility like that, he would like some visibility into what his users have signed up behind to support MIGO are coordinating among themselves. And he actually asked if he could become privy as an observer, Peter, to the coordinators group that you and Marika and Leo have as an observer of a major facility that's going to be involved in providing services to the astronomers who are asking for time in this facility. Yeah, we should offer that to any major facility that wants some visibility into the process from the operations of that facility.
So it was Andrea, David.
I wouldn't say much of the same thing that I said, but in my opinion, things like a while MOUs are a good organizing tool. They're helpful regardless of whether the information is accessible. But given the fact that we now are much more relaxed, I think scattered point to that thing, we really have to be careful. Now, we know we should stop watching, we should stop already equipment. And given the difference between the kinds of surgery, you guys have to be very careful, NWA, or lift onto a target for a lot of people, it's too much cost. And given the fact that there's very large amount of uncertainty between, how much gravitational wave addition you expect given, what's the relationship to the GW and ENM mission, we should just give, there should be a forum for all of the information we have to be somewhat, maybe not in formal alert, but there should be a choice on the ENM observer, you know, what to pick out of the pile of mostly junk, rather than going the other direction where we just put out a little bit.
Related to the discussions we had this morning about the next generation of sort of party and the way that we load it, and let's make sure that there is a big science community that wants to do something with those data. Are there some things that we could change in our near term interactions with astronomers, which would maximize the probability that there's a community in 2 to 3 to 5 years that says, yes, we must have a new observatory instead of a new telescope or a new satellite? Like, are there any changes in the way we interact with different communities now, which makes it super likable or regressing from labor products? Like, even when you have tools that are maximizing long term, how far we can get with the community.
Okay. I'm not sure the two of you agree.
We can hear from both.
First of all, I think actually we've done a pretty good job because we've, you know, gotten a pretty good cross section of the prominent EM follow up kind of people involved already. And with the offer of the public data coming in 03 next year, sometime, we will get even more people excited about this. And so then it's going to Then it'll really be determined by what kind of science discoveries come out of these joint observations. And once we have some of those, everybody will want to have the next generation instrument.
Right. So I was actually really happy with the interaction with LIGO, other than that inviting LIGO. We asked you. But I think that, you know, the two things that will really help is have freedom of conversation with LIGO scientists. That will happen. And, you know, tech 10 or 100 were black holes. That's, you know, they're not necessarily great. If you get a population of black holes distributed through space from 100 megaparsecs to 1,000 megaparsecs, there's things that cosmologists can do with that. So just maximizing the detection rate actually is of interest.
More questions? So we had, let's see, Leo, Ricardo, Fred. Leo, then Ricardo, and then Fred.
Just coming back to this idea of...
mic up. Close, put it close to your mouth.
Just back to this idea of having, like, all of the events that, you know, all of the triggers that we have and all of the information that we have in one place and leading it to astronomers to pick what they want. I mean, in principle, I think what we should be doing, but on the other hand, I think it is our responsibility as gravitational wave astronomers to do everything that we know how to do to separate the wheat from the chaff, to describe what, you know, describe the nature of the signals that we're seeing in the most concise way possible, and that's not to say that we should be as selective as we've been about what events that we send out in terms of the likelihood of being a false alarm. And it's not to say that we should not just send, we should not just tell people explicitly what are the masses that we estimate when we detect. But I think that we should do as much interpretation and as much vetting of events as we can, just to be as much. We can just dump everything in.
How do we say the same thing that maybe it is already done, assuming with the triggers set out an evolving parameter frame that you get all the triggers raw, and then in the next minute, 2 minutes, as the analysis evolves, you get more information. And is this something that we'd like to address?
Yes, very much. Something you can sign up for, more if you want to. Yeah.
Fred?
Going back to the 30 minutes, I think a mistake in retrospect that we made is we kind of assumed that all ventricle generators are created equal. And, you know, some of them, I think, are well proven now. And I would say you shouldn't just put it out and, you know, then claw back. Other ones are maybe a little more troubled and less reliable, and maybe you want to have a different world for those. It seems to me you could almost program those in. Then another issue is, I remember very much on Christmas Day being on the ship where, you know, we knew that we wouldn't believe anything Hanford was putting down because it was clearly troubled. But we didn't have a mechanism to reject the data automatically because we didn't know why we were having trouble, right? And sort of the way we do our detective categorization is we tend not to reject data unless we know why we were doing data, right? And, you know, I would love to have had a flag that said we can figure this out and forget about us, right? Because, you know, clearly, you know, when your range drops to 25% of what it's been, which is just there, jumping away, you know you're broke. And so I think we could really do a few things to where you just don't have to look at the data. You can just automatically veto it, you know, or you can automatically pass it based on certain conditions. And then there are other ones, you know, I remember when people were rejecting a trigger that was based on when the rapid response team looked at it, it was an MTBA trigger, and they knew that it was a particular class of problem that one event trigger generator would have. And yeah, so, you know, if it's got that guy's fingerprints on it, you want to pay more attention to it, right? But other ones, I think, you know, have good records, and we should just pass them on that.
Beverly? Oh, you wanted to answer?
Did I give her the chance to try? Do you want to answer that?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a brief comment that the detector characterization group is currently working on improving low latency data quality. So, in the not too distant future, we hope that flag will be there.
You know, on the theme of trusting the pipelines and wanting to see what works, you know, before at the run of the EM alerts for our test, we did some pretty neat consensus testing. So we had a series of, I don't know, maybe a dozen, something like a dozen semi-blind, something like a dozen unmarked parking positions that were in. And we were able to see the difference. So my point is that I think that certainly we have our experience, but we can also design specific targets that might be something we put on the radar for. I was talking to Peter earlier this morning. He was mentioning that we have a mechanism to see a machine generated list from events in essentially real time in a closed channel, which is the gold data, and you really have to read part of the gold data before I look at the phenomenon.
We have a question from TeamSpeak, and then Ray. First, the TeamSpeak, and then Ray.
Hi, everyone.
Yes, go ahead.
It's Yuri Van Leeuwen from Astron. I run Aperitif, so that's a radio follow-up observation that has fast slewing. I just want to make make a note that for some of these follow-up observatories, there are times when we can actually accommodate triggers that are maybe a little bit lower reliability, but especially if they were sent quickly, could be followed up. So more events, even if with minimal vetting, but sent quite quickly, could work pretty well for a number of these follow-up telescopes. Thanks.
Thank you. Right.
I have a question for the astronomer. If you had to take a gamble, what would be the best shot that you could take to try to look for an electromagnetic charge to the black hole collision? What would you think? I haven't followed, since our discovery, I haven't followed any of the thinking. If you guys must have some opinion.
Two black holes.
Because that's the thing we saw.
Yeah.
And if you were going to look for it electromagnetically, what is your best shot at the thinking that you might see something?
I guess I have to read. I mean, theoretically, it should be severely electromagnetically weak, but the black holes could have accretion disk. You know, the things they haven't thought about in the past that now everyone's theorizing about. And so they're definitely worth following up. And the best case would be the most statistic probability of nearby, one that's a little bit nearby. And so that you might be able to see something. But if there's perhaps jetted emission, you know, it would only be rarely that the EM emission would be aimed in our direction, so it's worth it to keep trying.
I guess it depends on the jet emission. The jets are genetic. You can radio within a UV market as fast as you can, your seconds have to get better. And that can be sort of thing, depending on the number of years, the day or the month. That's a good
one. Thank you. And all the things you've mentioned said quickly, that's what you want to get to. You may not be able to find it, it's too far away.
The current data is that the most widely defined polymer black hole polymer emerging is time and density of the top black hole. Because every indication that I might be a big telescope, but we're finding black holes.
So I wonder if Antonia or Jory want to comment as well from the radio perspective.
Hi, so I think I heard the question correctly. It was for a black hole merger, what's the best chance of getting an EM counterpart, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so I think I agree that, you know, any sort of jetted emission is going to be very, very weak and it's going to be very difficult to find. I think for me, an interesting, but I don't know how probable it is if, say, you have a black hole, or if black holes have charge or a magnetic field, that you might get some sort of reconnection event that could produce a very prompt pulse. And that then could be either in, say, gamma rays or maybe even like a low frequency or a fast radio burst type emission. So I would go fast, you know, basically.
Thank you.
Well, there could be a tertiary object, too. There could be some non-black hole tertiary object that would get torn apart, which I've heard other people talk about, too. Did you want to say that? I have to say, we're going to follow up one or two black hole areas. Yes, because there might be something.
All right, so it's 6:05. Any other questions, comments, contributions anybody would like to make, considering it's 6:05? All right, so thank you to all the panelists and the speakers.